This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. On this podcast, the spotlight is on the Family and Medical Leave Act. It's been nearly 20 years since the passage of the FMLA, and yet it remains an area of confusion at times. Joining us to answer some key questions arising under the FMLA is Casey Kurtz, a shareholder with Littler Mendelsohn's Pittsburgh office. Casey, welcome.
Thanks, David. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and the Family and Medical Leave Act is such a big issue because it can affect men as well as women and goes beyond childbirth, of course, to involve caring for a sick child, parent, or oneself. So with that said, Casey, what's the number one question you hear from employers about the FMLA?
Well, we get certainly a lot of questions about the FMLA, and it's certainly an intricate statute with regulations that provide a lot of pitfalls for employers to fall through. But I'd say the biggest question I get or most frequent question is a very broad one. How do I run my business with so many employees taking FMLA leave, including intermittent leave?
Yeah, that's interesting because Casey was one of the co-authors of the FMLA content on ExpertHR.com. And one of the things you wrote about was involving the abuse of intermittent leave. Tell us about that and how that issue is arising.
In most cases, it's an employer who has a reasonable belief that an employee is taking advantage of the generous FMLA leave entitlement, and most often that comes up when they're taking intermittent time off. The Act provides for employees taking leave not just in solid chunks of time, but a day at a time, a couple days at a time, which can be very frustrating and have a big impact on employer operations. So in many cases, employers will get some information, whether it be the pattern of time that the employee is using their intermittent leave or the other information from, say, a coworker that indicates that the employee is invoking their FMLA intermittent leave, but is in fact taking time off to extend a weekend, for example, extend a holiday, or avoid a difficult task or an anticipated difficult day at work. So situations where the employer has reason to believe the employee is in fact medically able to work, but they are invoking FMLA leave.
One of the ways that employers are tracking FMLA abuses these days is through social media, but that seems like a potential double-edged sword as well. Any dangers in that as far as employee privacy is concerned?
You could have some potential privacy issues in that situation, David. Where this comes up is employers going online to determine or look at social media sites to determine what the employee may be doing on the day that they are taking intermittent leave or the time that they're using for intermittent leave. So the privacy issues can arise when the employer uses any kind of subterfuge to access online content that's intended as private. So if someone as an employer accesses a Facebook page, for example, that is designated as private by using someone else's access method, that can certainly be an issue, a privacy issue. The other significant concern is employers who use even publicly posted information that appears to indicate the abuse of FMLA leave, but is in reality ambiguous. What I mean by that is, for example, an employee says on her webpage that she was at the mall all day on the day she called off for FMLA reasons. You know, that certainly may prompt suspicion with the employer that the employee didn't in fact need FMLA leave. However, it doesn't necessarily present an open and shut case of FMLA fraud. If the employee has a medical condition, it may be consistent with that medical condition that the employee can go to the mall but can't perform his or her essential job functions. So in that situation, an employer can overstep if they react quickly without really a reasoned approach to information that they find on the internet.
Casey, how about the interplay of the FMLA and the Americans with Disabilities Act? these statutes often overlap and yet really do quite different things. Any misconceptions in that regard when an employee couples a leave request with one for accommodation?
This is a big source of confusion for employers. The difficulty is really rooted in the fact that these statutes were not drafted together, and as you mentioned, they provide for different entitlements and provide different standards for determining whether an employee has a right to receive an accommodation in regards to the ADA and leave under the FMLA. The other difficulty or confusion arises from the fact that the EEOC has made very clear that leave can be a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. So the challenge that is presented is negotiating these two statutes that really kind of run parallel to each other, but one takes a back seat in certain circumstances. So let me give you an example. If an employee who is not eligible for FMLA yet because they haven't worked the requisite hours, I've seen certainly employers who say the employee who's seeking leave in that circumstance is told, you're not eligible for FMLA, you're not eligible for leave. Well, the problem is if the employee has a disability, and that is what the employee is seeking leave for, the ADA would step in and require the interactive process to occur to determine if the employee is entitled to an accommodation, which, as I mentioned, can include leave. So two different statutes, but can provide a similar benefit to employees in different circumstances.
Generally speaking, what's the biggest mistake that you see or hear about HR professionals making when it comes to issues arising out of the FMLA?
Well, the biggest mistake and the most costly goes back to the FMLA-ADA interplay issue. And that is employers who conclude that when an employee fails to return to work after the expiration of FMLA leave, the employer concludes that, hey, I'm now permitted, because the 12 weeks have been exhausted, to terminate the employee if the employee does not return at that time from leave. But because the ADA, as I mentioned earlier, is running parallel to the FMLA, it can kick in at that point and entitle a person who is not returning because of a disability to an accommodation, which can include extending that FMLA leave entitlement to a longer period. So the problem becomes not engaging in the interactive process when an employee who's out for a serious health condition seeks additional leave or indicates an inability to return immediately upon the expiration of their FMLA entitlement. There's a lot of EEOC litigation regarding this issue, where employers are having a very rigid policy that says when you reach the end of FMLA leave, or it could be also the end of STD benefits, or in some cases, employers have a policy that says at the end of 1 year of consecutive leave, employees are automatically terminated. The EEOC has been launching class actions and garnering significant settlements from employers who have these types of policies and allegedly are not permitting the interactive process to occur in order to allow for the potential for extended leave as an accommodation.
And for those who aren't aware, Casey, what did you mean by STD benefits?
Short-term disability benefits. Often employers will provide a short-term disability benefit. Frequently, that's a 26-week period where employees who are disabled can receive some kind of wage replacement. And oftentimes, employers will have policies that are keyed to the end of those benefits and that provide that once those benefits are exhausted, employees who cannot return are administratively separated.
Again, we're speaking with Littler Mendelson employment attorney Casey Kurtz, who practices with the firm's Pittsburgh office. Casey, the Department of Labor recently made news with its regulations expanding the rights of caregivers to take leave under the FMLA to care for injured returning service members. What can you tell us about that?
In January 2012, the Department of Labor released a proposed rule that implements the Family Medical Leave Act amendments that were issued in 2010. And those related to the military leave aspects of FMLA, as well as a statute that addressed a unique issue for airline employees, where airline employees, because of their unique scheduling issues, were not eligible for FMLA in certain situations. So these proposed regulations clarify and again, implement the aspect of expanding, for instance, military exigency leave to members of the regular armed forces, in addition to the reserve and National Guard members. With regard to military caregiver leave, the proposed regulations implement the idea that veterans would be covered, that you can receive leave to care for certain veterans within the 5-year period after they are discharged from the military on an honorable basis. So these regulations will clarify the ways in which those individuals might be eligible for leave for issues relating to family members who are in the military.
The Supreme Court has only had 3 rulings to date on the Family and Medical Leave Act, but one of those came just this year in a case decided in March 2012 that appears to help public employers quite a bit. Casey, what can you tell us about Coleman versus Maryland?
Yeah, in the Coleman case, David, the Supreme Court ruled that states may not be sued for monetary damages by their employees for FMLA violations where the employee's FMLA claim is based on the self-care provision of the FMLA. So the FMLA obviously provides for different types of leave, including family care leave. This particular case dealt with a state alleging that it was not obligated to pay monetary damages to an employee who took leave for his own medical condition, so the self-care provision. And the court ruled that Congress did not properly abrogate states' sovereign immunity from these types of claims when it passed the FMLA originally. Now, the court's ruling does not affect state employees' entitlement to FMLA. It only affects their ability to recover monetary damages from their employers. They can still obtain injunctive relief, and the Department of Labor can still initiate actions that can recover monetary damages from states.
Now, critics, though, including Justice Ginsburg in dissent in that case, have said that this ruling will make it more difficult for women in particular to live balanced lives at home and also enjoy gainful employment. As one who represents employers, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I don't think it's as broad, certainly, as Justice Ginsburg characterized it. As I mentioned, employees are still entitled, the same employees who are prohibited from seeking monetary damages themselves under this decision are still entitled to leave itself, are still entitled to injunctive relief. In addition, many state FMLA laws would provide for monetary damages if there was a similar violation to what was addressed in the Coleman case. So I certainly don't see it as broad an issue as was characterized in the dissent's opinion.
And just to be clear, this case doesn't have much impact as far as private employers are concerned?
No, it really doesn't, David. It has no bearing on the private employer.
Well, only a minute or so left before we let you go, Casey. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask if there's any other key trends surrounding the act that employers should be on the lookout for this year and even beyond.
Well, I think a big one, David, is the impact of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act on employers' notice requirements and seeking of certifications in support of FMLA leave. The Department of Labor has forms that are in place currently, suggested forms or model forms that employers can use that have not yet been updated to incorporate language under GINA that would provide a safe harbor for employers. So briefly, GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, provides that employers are limited from seeking certain genetic information relating to their employees. There are carve-outs under that law for seeking information that would relate to family care leave. So it's inevitable that a family member's medical condition, which can be considered genetic information under GINA, is something that the employer has an entitlement to receive. So there is a carve out for that. But what is a stumbling block here for employers is that if they are just using the Department of Labor's forms as presently constituted, the GINA language is not included in that. And what the GINA language does is if in response to a medical inquiry, a provider provides genetic information to the employer, that safe harbor language protects the employer from liability under GINA. So that's a very important issue that I think will percolate up as we proceed, since GINA is a relatively new law.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like one to watch. Well, Casey, I want to thank you so much for your insightful comments and for joining us on this podcast.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you.
Casey Kurtz is a shareholder with Littler Mendelsohn's Pittsburgh office. He also co-authored much of the Family and Medical Leave Act content on the ExpertHR.com website.
The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR and our subscription offering, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. Copyright 2012, all rights reserved.